Okay. We are going to try to, we have several things on the agenda for today. We will try to do the rest of our proposals for bonding requests tomorrow. And that will hopefully get us over this little hump every time we miss a meeting. And, of course, on Tuesday of next week, we're going to Waseca. So, yes, Mr. Heidbergen, Representative Heidbergen.
Thank you. This might be an appropriate question for, I think, for a lot of us that haven't gone through a whole lot of bonding in education. How often is it that a school district comes to us for bonding for the particular projects? Is this a commonality, or is this these are exceptions to the rule when they come and ask for help?
I think what we'll do is we'll give you the history of why these are here. No, I wouldn't say it's very common for school districts to come here for additional money. So I think I'll let staff run through kind of why we have these particular ones before us today. And the things that are before us today were also before us a year ago. And so we made recommendations at that time, and I think we will probably stick fairly close to the recommendations made at that time this year also. But it's important for everybody here to hear the history, and then after that, I just want to mention to you some things I think you should think about when you're looking at bonding, you know, on whether or not we want to bond certain projects, some things that I think are important to think about. So I'll talk about that after Mr. Crow has had a chance to go through what we're doing here today.
Madam Chair, Representative Heidbergen, I think one way to think about your question is to put it in context. And as you're aware, most school districts, when they do building projects, they do those by issuing locally authorized bonds that are then primarily repaid with local property tax revenue. And there's a series of exceptions to that, and let me give you a few of those categories of exceptions. One of the largest areas of exceptions are things called the maximum effort school loans. And that's a program we'll talk about in detail at a later date. But essentially what that is a program that's been in existence since 1959 that helps very low tax-based school districts with their facility needs. There's been a couple hundred million dollars of state bond money that's gone into that program over the last 40 years. That's probably the biggest place where the state has spent state general obligation bonds on school building projects. And as I said, we'll speak about that in some detail a little later. A second area is that the legislature has authorized a variety of cooperative programs over time. Some of those are to help school districts consolidate, and the most prominent amongst those was the Cooperative Secondary Facility Grant Program. Others of the cooperative programs, including the Metropolitan Magnet School Program, have been designed to serve other purposes. That was a program that was implemented in the 94 legislative session, and the goal was to get districts to voluntarily work on desegregation efforts, and if they needed building space, the state would make capital grants to them. A third area where this committee has had responsibility for state bonding proceeds are for things like the state academies and the Perfect School for the Arts. Both are institutions which don't have access to the property tax base. And then the fourth area is there's been a whole variety of small, and relatively small dollar amount as well, but a variety of smaller programs and projects where they're not in response to a legislatively initiated program, but rather an individual school district's idea as to what to do. And an example of those was a few years back, the legislature passed state bond proceeds, authority for state bond proceeds for the Grand Meadow School for a portion of the cost of that school, which was a series of monolithic domes. And the rationale behind that was that this is a new construction technique that could save school districts money. That was the stated rationale at the time. So that's an example of a project-specific bonding proposal. But that may give you some flavor for the kinds of bonding requests that generally come to the K-12 committee.
Thank you very much, Mr. Strom, not Mr. Crow, who's giving us that update. A couple of things that I think you ought to be thinking about as we go forward here with bonding and with making recommendations to the big capital investment committee in the sky here. First of all, is this a project that's important for state government? And do we as a state have a fundamental obligation to fund this particular project? Is it worth paying debt service for 20 years? Is it a critical infrastructure piece, or is it kind of an additional amenity? I mean, there have been times we built swimming pools for people, you know, monuments in their state parks, all that kind of thing. Is that critical to education? I mean, I think, you know, these are all areas that you have ought to think about. And then, you know, if it's being built on a projection of usage, are those reasonable projections? We have done some things in the past where the projections were for high usage, and that hasn't happened. And so I think we need to look at those areas. And then just, you know, has the state invested a lot in this same area in the past? And have the things that we've been investing in, have they been maintained in a responsible fashion? And then I guess I would say if we're looking to do something that puts out planning money, which means that in the next 2 years we are obligated to spend money on a building because we gave them planning money at this point in time. I mean, those are all things to consider. It shouldn't be just, gee, this sounds great, let's do it, or I don't like the sound of this, let's not. It's kind of, you need to look a little beyond that at why we're hearing it and why we're considering it, and whether it's something that we really think is important that we do as a state. So, with that in mind, we'll first call on the Department of Education, and the Department of Education will go through the request that the department has put forward.
Yeah.
And I think in your folders, you have a list of their requests, right? I haven't got mine.
Madam Chair.
You can see these.
Madam Chair and members, the dollar amounts on lines 9 and 11 for the Duluth Magnet School Grant and East Metro Magnet School Grant were transposed for Governor 2005. So if you just reverse those, they both amount to about $1.1 million. But if you just switch those two numbers, that would be correct.
Ms. Anderson.
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Chaz Anderson, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Education. The governor has recommended three projects in the governor's bonding bill, the first one being the Duluth project. This is one that is back from last year. This provides for expansion and renovation and an existing school site. This one has a kind of a long history. It started out, was funded in the 2000 bonding bill under the after-school enrichment grants. At the time, that was general fund cash, and it was inadvertently canceled as part of the 2003 bonding cancellations. And so the governor is recommending $1.157 million for the project. That is up from last year due to an 8.63 inflation factor that the Department of Finance put in for that project. The second project is the Red Lake project. This is a capital grant for a new middle school in Red Lake. The governor is recommending $24,040,000. Again, the Department of Finance applied an 8.63 inflation to that number from last year. That project is part of probably about two school districts that would qualify for that since the 2001 property tax changes. Red Lake and Net Lake are the two districts that have property tax values where they are unable to build their own buildings through their voters. So the governor is recommending $24,040,000 for a new middle school. The last recommendation is another recommendation from last year. It is to pay a court judgment decision in the East Metro Magnet School, Crosswinds Middle School. I think it involved paying for the cost of land acquisition. And the governor is recommending $1,083,000. That is up 2.75% from last year, and that is because of interest that has accrued on the court decision. With that, Madam Chair, we could take questions, or we can just start with the individual projects. And I know that people are here to testify and answer questions individually about their projects.
Right, we have them. We do have them on the agenda. Representative Biskins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, Ms. Anderson, just one question. I guess from my understanding and clarification, I guess I'd like to know how property tax is figured out in a tribal school district. If the bulk of the Red Lake School District is on tribal land, and property taxes are not assessed and or collected on tribal lands, how does the Department of Education then determine whether or not that is a property tax poor district? It would seem to me that they all would be, unless I'm missing something. So having that understanding would be helpful.
The Red Lake.
Would you introduce yourself, please?
Expansory. I'm Audrey Bonser from the Department of Education. The Red Lake School District and the Red Lake Reservation have contiguous borders. As I understand, most of the land on the reservation is owned by the tribe communally. It is not subject to property tax. The market value of the taxable property in Red Lake is about $860,000. Given the 15% net debt limit, this means that Red Lake can, by bonding, raise about $93,000. So they simply do not have the taxable property that allows them to tax property taxpayers to build their own facility.
Representative Biskins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. But then the more fundamental question, if that's how the calculations are completed, would that not be the same for every tribal school district, irrespective of the business operations within that school district, i.e., if the Mille Lacs Band were to create a school district and the casinos are on the tribal property, but the tribal property and the business that are on them are not subject to the property tax using your calculating methodology. I don't see how any school district that is within tribal lands could ever pass any kind of threshold of being property wealthy. Or
members, I think
Ms. Bomstead.
One of the issues is that this is actually a Minnesota public independent school district. It is not a tribal school, as you will find on the Mille Lacs Reservation. They do have a tribal school that is supported by the tribe. This is a public Minnesota public school district.
And this is the only one of the tribes that have a public district, correct? A Minnesota public school district.
It is a unique in the fact that they have contiguous borders and have chosen many, many years ago, I don't know the exact history, and I know Red Lake will be able to testify that, chose to be a public school rather than a tribal school.
And one follow-up question, Ms. Bomstead, to Representative Biskins. So that is the value of the land on the reservation. Is the land surrounding the reservation then also taxed at that very low rate? Is it valued at that same low valuation?
To be perfectly honest, I don't know how tribal lands are valued. However, under federal law, they are not taxable.
Okay. Thank you. Was there any further question? Then let's move forward with the agenda that we have here. And you ladies may wish to be around to answer questions that come up. We'll hear from Independent School District number 709, which is Duluth, for the Grant Magnet School project. And I believe Representative Huntley is out of town, so Representative Yaros, you will do that? Okay.
Yes. Madam Sikora and the members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity. As Ms. Anderson stated, this is House File 96, restores the funding that was once granted to Grant School a few years ago, and it was taken away by in 2003 when the state needed money. So the school district teachers and administrators and community members appreciate the department's recommendation to restore this funding, and we really appreciate the support of the governor that he gave to this very important project. The community, the teachers and administrators of this school district 709 have done an excellent job, and here are some of them that will testify.
First of all, thank you for the opportunity to talk with you this afternoon. I am Gary Bergren, the principal at Grant Magnet School, and I have three other people with me today. Kathy Bogan is one of the co-directors of the Grant School Community Collaborative, and she has a great deal of involvement with the whole process for this edition. Jay Newcomb is here from the College of St. Scholastica, and he is the partner and service learning representative for our collaborative. And also we have Mr. Ed Marsman, who is the director of school operations with ISD 709. We'd like to keep this very brief if possible. Mm-hmm. We'd like to be also able to answer questions that you may have. We'll start with Kathy Bogan and Jay Newcomb, who are going to give us a little update and a very brief history of this project.
Welcome. Thank you. It's very nice to be here. Madam Chair and members of the committee, I thank you for this opportunity to speak with you and give you a few updates. I can see you've received quite a volume of information about this project, and we did present to you last year. The significant updates that I'd like to share with you about the grant, now Language and Arts Magnet School, is that we are increasing our enrollment due to a closure of a school in an adjoining attendance area, and the participation of many parents from that school who have worked with us on enhancing our language magnet and our programming. Probably most significant, however, to our after-school and family programs is the fact that we have become now a designated 21st century learning community, and therefore we are really expanding the kinds of after-school enrichment, summer, and family programming that are occurring at this site. At the time that we requested this project, in fact, the project really was first brought together in 1998, recognizing that this part of Duluth geographically is really a very densely populated pocket of poverty that in which residents need expanded educational opportunities. This situation still exists, and the programs that we now are able to serve our community with have been successful in meeting a lot of those needs. However, we're becoming even more cramped for space, and so the need for this extended learning center really is what it is, and I do need to make that distinction. We're looking at a space in which we can offer community education in the extended hours of the school has become even greater.
Ms. Bogan, yes. I have a quick question for you. Is Bogan, is that correct?
Bogan, yeah.
Okay. You said you've become a 21st century learning community.
Yes.
Now, those are generally grants. All right.
Yes.
Does that mean you're guaranteed a grant all the time, every year?
It's a three-year at this point. It's a three-year.
We're continuously working on new resources and grant funding, and the 21st century is a three-year grant.
Mm-hmm. It's a three-year grant, okay. I didn't think it was permanent, that's why I was curious. Mm-hmm. If by the time you build this, you will have about 1 year left in your grant. And I was curious whether the grant would continue, so you would continue to have the increased enrollment in the program. Go ahead.
And if I could just give a little context for the community school model that we use at Grant, we think of the community of the East Hillside around Grant as not only the context or the place where kids go to school, but also as a resource for the children, so that we introduce and include parents and community resources as part of the total educational model. And this has been really important and effective in involving low-income families and families of color who are often excluded from the educational process. The community, the parents and the community are really part of the educational basis. And one example would be last summer, our community play was based on stories of elders who had lived in Duluth for 50, 60 years, and what was it like to be a person of color in Duluth 20 years ago? That was the basis of our play, so that we were able to bring in the families and the experience. The other side of the collaboration that I bring to this project is from the College of St. Scholastica. This last February, the college and the collaboration together won the Minnesota Community Partnership Award, the Jimmy Carter Community Collaboration Award. And CSS sees itself as an asset in the community. The college is a part of this community, and really we are invested in the success of these children. We don't just send our students down to participate in grant school programs. We're a part of those programs. Those programs are a part of our curriculum. They're very important both for the children of the school and for the students in our college who are able to get good multicultural experiences by participating in these successful programs.
Sir, I don't think we got your name when you started speaking. Would you give us your name so we have that on tape and for everybody here as well?
My name is Jay Newcomb.
Jay Newcomb. I thought it was Jay something, but I wasn't sure what the last name was. All right, Representative Heidgerken.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to go back to Ms. Bogan. You had mentioned that in your presentation for the need of this project, you had mentioned that there was a close Lyon school district or school that closed, and because of that you have an increase of enrollment. Was this school on the reservation or was it outside the reservation?
It's a public school.
Public school it was?
Yeah.
Where was this school located?
In Duluth.
Public school in Duluth.
In Duluth.
In Duluth, okay.
Yeah, just about a mile from, 2 miles.
Oh, okay.
From our...
Okay. Could I clarify? This is ISD 709 Duluth Schools.
Right.
We are not connected with the other project.
Right. I was just going to make that clarification. Thank you. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I didn't really have a question yet, but I will go ahead and ask Sister Strom, what is the historical background on our funding this kind of magnet school?
Madam Chair, Representative Erickson, the grants that were made, there were a series of grants that were made back when the legislature had the Early Childhood Family Committee. A variety of building grants were made for extended community use space in school districts, and we could look up the number for those and get those for you in a few minutes. But there were a number that were made in that year. I believe it was 1999 or 2000, and I think Duluth was the only one of those for which the funding was not implemented prior to the 2003 cancellation.
Thank you. All right. Hearing no further questions.
Madam Chair.
Oh, Representative Clemson, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Strong, there's a number of activity centers being built and community/activity centers built attached to high schools and middle schools and elementary schools in the metro, and it was my understanding that they qualified for the same sort of school bonding. Would this not be able to fall under that same qualification?
Madam Chair, Representative Clemson, this
Mr.
did
Strong.
Fall under that same program. And the issue, and you may want to ask the folks from Duluth the issues about the timing up there, but the other projects essentially got underway in 2003 when the legislature was reexamining bonding projects that had already been authorized but for which funding had not yet been spent. They canceled back this project because the project had not gotten underway yet. So it's the same source of funding as those other programs.
So follow up, Madam Chair.
Representative Clinton.
So if an activity center is built attached to a high school, that is not paid for with a school levy or school bonding authority. That was through the state obligated bonds instead.
Madam Chair, Representative Quincy, generally it's paid through the local bond proceeds, but there was a program and a series of grants that were awarded in 2000, and so there were a whole variety of these style of projects that were funded in 2000. And we'll get that list for you in a few minutes of the ones that were funded. But essentially this one was canceled back, and that's what distinguishes it from the others that went ahead with their projects.
Madam Chair,
Representative Clinton.
Thank you. So does this kind of project qualify for the same type of school bonding authority that an activity center would qualify for?
Mr.
Strong.
Representative Clinton, as I understand it, those grants in 2000 were essentially one-time grants, and so they aren't made. There's not a reserve set of money for that. There was specific bonding authority for that year for those projects, and since that time, since 2000, that bonding authority has not been put for the community centers.
Representative Diskins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I think Representative Quinting asked my question. I would like to follow up one more clarifier with Mr. Strom. Mr. Strom, would this type of project, if there was not money in the capital bill this year, would this type of project be an allowable project for the school board to go to the voters for a bond referenda?
Madam Chair, Representative Biskins, I'm sorry, I must have been misunderstanding the second part of Representative Clinton's question. Yes, a school district could go to the voters and bond for a community center or a portion of a school that served as a community center.
All right, Madam Chair.
Representative Fiskins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, to the testifiers, as I look at the scope of the project, we have a full-size gym, a stage, shower facilities, and then four large multi-purpose rooms. So as far as being able to handle an increase in enrollment due to the closing of another building is what I hear one of the needs that are driving this. What extent of the scope of the project is actually going in to create an academic learning space?
Would you introduce yourself, please?
My name is F. Meisman. I'm Director of School Operation, ISD 709, Duluth, Minnesota. This request and this proposal is a proposal that has been on the books for the last 5 years, so it is really not connected to the closure of a neighborhood school. What will happen is by closing the neighboring school, it will really intensify the lack of space that was existing in previous conditions. The proposal really addresses the extending learning day of students and addresses the desegregation effort that the state has in place and that the school wants to address by the magnet school concept and the extended magnet school concept now. So there was a serious need for the proposal that is in front of you in past conditions to address the space needed for after-school activities. Mm-hmm. That need is really accentuated in this upcoming year now that we are anticipating an increased enrollment in the Grand Magnet School by the Magnet program to address desegregation efforts and by the Enhanced program that's now in place that will attract students from all across the city, which really is addressing the desegregation efforts of the state.
Representative Wilson.
I'm sorry, thank you for your indulgence, Madam Chair. Then getting to the DSEG concept and the concept of magnet schools and the development, another question then for Mr. Strom or Mr. Crow. The cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul both extensively use the magnet school concept, all right, as to provide choices for parents and something I strongly support. How much involvement has the state had in funding their building construction and/or renovation projects at the magnet school level?
Madam Chair, Representative Fiskins, the state does a couple of things in regard to Minneapolis and St. Paul with their building needs. The first of those is Minneapolis and St. Paul can bond without voter approval, subject to the limits set by the legislature. So much of the construction of magnet schools and the changes in school district buildings in Minneapolis and St. Paul are done under that authority where the legislature has allowed them to bond without voter approval. Secondly, there is a specific program, and we'll talk about this with Representative Plinzing's bill, called the Metropolitan Magnet School Grant Program. And we've spent a little over $45 million in total for a series of metro magnets, including the downtown magnet school, the Crosswind School, and the Fair School, the St. Louis Park School, and there's a second East Metro school as well. So that's the second way that the legislature has directly been involved in those building decisions in Minneapolis and St. Paul.
Mr. Strom, you mentioned that Minneapolis and St. Paul do have some bonding authority, or pardon me, some levying authority or bonding authority without going to the voters, right? Don't all the cities of the first class, wouldn't Duluth also have that same authority?
No, Madam Chair, this is special authority that's passed every 6 years or so, or every 8 years, where the legislature grants Minneapolis and St. Paul the authority to sell bonds without voter approval. There are some limitations on that, but then there's a fixed dollar amount that's put in the law.
Okay, is there, I would just ask this as background, but I think it's important that we know. Is there any private dollars going into this, any community dollars, any Duluth school district dollars? Is there anything other than just coming to the state? Is there anything else going into this project from some other local or public-private partnership or something like that of some kind?
In the original proposal written in 2000, there was a $100,000 promise from the local Ardeen Foundation to contribute to the project. Since that time, they have rescinded that offer due to lowering of their cash balances, I guess, in their foundation. But originally there was that $100,000 as part of the
So is that recognized, Mr. Newcomb, is that recognized in your request that you want another $100,000, or is that not?
I believe it is already included in the total that is included in the request now, because the original request from the state was for $900,000 plus $100,000 from the Ardeen Foundation.
So now we're at $1,083,000.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Are there any other questions from the committee? Otherwise, this request will be held over. We will have some discussion as to, you know, what we will recommend to go forward to the bonding committee, and we have a very short span of time in which to do it. So I thank you very much for your information and for being here and making the trip down. And we will go forward with...
Thank you for the opportunity.
We'll go forward with the next issue, which is the Representative Plinzing, House File 410, the Joint Powers District number 6067. East Metro Integration. They have such a high number. And I think this is the one that we'll need a fairly succinct explanation of, because this is, as Mr. Strom said earlier, this is kind of a different proposal or kind of a different request.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm the Representative Plinzing for the record, and I'm not going to talk very long because I have laryngitis and I've had it for a few days, so no more long-winded speeches from me. It is a unique district that has a unique request, and we do have some very expert witnesses here today to kind of explain the history of it, as the district as well as the request, and kind of the timeline of what's happened and why they're before us today needing this bonding request. So at this time, I'll just leave it to the expert testifiers.
And would you introduce yourself, please?
Madam Chair and committee members, my name is Carl Wallstrom. I'm the superintendent of the East Metro Integration District 6067. With me at the table today is Jay Squires, EMID's attorney, who will address some of the background issues related to the settlement agreement and the loan arrangement for this property. We're here today to provide background, as has been indicated, on the bonding request to complete acquisition of the property for the Crosswinds Middle School. Crosswinds is one of two magnet schools that EMID operates. The other is the Harambe Elementary School, was referenced earlier by Mr. Strom in his response. The materials that we provided for you indicate that the legislature, since 1998, has provided grants for the construction of this school. Initially, those grants were provided to the St. Paul School District, who served as the fiscal agent for East Metro Integration District prior to the formation of the Joint Powers District in the late 1990s. Approximately $22.8 million was provided over several sessions for the construction of this school. Essentially, the parties were unable to come to agreement with regard to the fair market value of the property on which this school was to be constructed. It's a 37-acre parcel. It's in the city of Woodbury, one of the 10, or in District 833, which is one of the 10 component districts in East Metro. I believe you have the information in your materials that identify the 10 member districts that comprise the East Metro Integration District. The court became involved in attempting to arrive at the fair market value of the property, and ultimately a settlement agreement was arrived at, which established the value of the property in excess of what had been provided through prior appropriations. We have copies of that settlement agreement with us today. If members of the committee would like to review that, we have copies of that available. This past fall, the original terms of the settlement agreement came due. In other words, on the 31st of August, EMID was obligated to pay the property owners the outstanding amount, $1,064,000. The settlement agreement anticipated a bonding bill in the 2004 session. In the absence of that bonding bill, we attempted to ask the work with the property owners to extend the agreement to give us the 2005 session to come back to the legislature and try to satisfy this obligation. The district faced increased costs in that approach and also some potentially increased litigation. And so rather than taking that approach, we entered into a loan arrangement with the St. Paul School District to allow the property owners to be satisfied with regard to the outstanding amount. So the request today is really to repay a loan to the St. Paul schools from their capital facility revenue to allow us to satisfy this outstanding obligation. At this time, I'd like to ask Jay Squires, attorney with Ratwick, Bozak, and Maloney, to provide a little bit of background on the original property settlement as well as the loan arrangement. Madam Chair, Mr. Squires.
Mr. Squires.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I will try not to be redundant of Superintendent Wallstrom's comments, but to add to some of them. This property, as the superintendent mentioned, was acquired through the use of condemnation. East Metro, as a joint powers entity, has condemnation authority. As is the case in condemnation, the process envisions that a panel of three members are appointed by the court, and they determine the value of the property. And as is always the case in condemnation, the parties came into the process with very different views and opinions from appraisers on the value of the property and what should be paid by East Metro in the condemnation action. The commission, condemnation commission, rendered an award, and that award was appealed by the property owners. And in the appeal, which is a district court action, the district court judge directed the parties to mediate the dispute. That mediation was conducted by an attorney from St. Paul who's now retired named John Bannigan, who spent largely his career in the condemnation area. And as a product of that mediation, a tentative settlement was reached resolving the case. That settlement was presented to the EMID board, and the board deliberated, and the board, based on the advice of counsel, accepted that settlement. As settlements of litigation often go, it was more than they would have liked to have paid, but it was substantially less than the worst case scenario, which would have been, adding together the costs and exposure, would have been in excess of $1 million more than the settlement all in total. The board determined as a result of the process that that was the most fiscally prudent thing to do, as is often the deliberative process in that circumstance. That agreement, as Superintendent Wallstrom mentioned, provided for a delayed payment, which was the second important feature of the agreement, to allow the district to come in and to present the shortfall to the legislature. And of course, with the lack of a bonding bill, that time came and went this last fall. We approached, when that deadline approached, we approached the property owners and attempted to negotiate an extension of that agreement, and the property owners were unwilling to do that, and in fact asserted that they would be damaged in a number of different ways, perhaps by as much as an additional $1 million. As a result of that, the EMID board also had to look at that and consider all its options about financing to deal with that situation, and again, from a fiscal standpoint, to minimize the exposure to additional costs yet again. And that resulted in an agreement whereby the St. Paul School District advanced the money to the East Metro Board on a provisional basis to allow the obligations of the property owner to be satisfied, to take that out of the equation. And as a result of that agreement, that takes us to where we are currently with the request for the funding.
All right, Representative Biskins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Squires, can you spell out for this committee your agreement with the St. Paul School District? You mentioned on a provisional basis. I'm sure the provisions are probably twofold. What happens if the legislature chooses to fund this project, and what happens if it does not? Particularly on the latter, how does the contract read?
Mr. Squires.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The contract really is in the form of a resolution simply by the East Metro Board and the St. Paul Board providing for this advancement of funds. And it has a absolute deadline for repayment whereby, as I recall, and the Superintendent may correct me, I think September 1 was the date on which East Metro is obligated to repay St. Paul. It does not contain any provisions for non-appropriation by the legislature. It simply is a statement that East Metro is obligated to make that payment by that date.
So, Madam Chair.
Representative Biskins.
So, Madam Chair, Mr. Squires, then the obvious result would be that East Metro would have to pay that out of their operating reserves. Is that correct? Or Mr. Wallstrom, if you could address this.
Dr. Wallstrom.
Madam Chair and committee members and representative, the alternative for the district is to meet the obligation from its operating budget and with the cooperation of its member districts with respect to their integration revenue budgets.
Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Superintendent. I guess, you know, Madam Chair, I'm not going to rehash my concerns with this bill. I stated them last session, but you know, I think we have a process here that one needs to scratch their head over, all right? You know, and that's the fact that we have the St. Paul School Districts and the East Metro District entering into an agreement and then expecting the state taxpayers to fund the agreement they entered into. And that is, while maybe not unprecedented, is a process, I think, that is and should be of great concern to the people who have the fiduciary responsibility of all taxpayers in the state of Minnesota. Thank you.
I think, Representative Biskins, that, you know, when you look at the other metro magnet schools, I believe we had also funded those magnet schools, and that was part of an agreement early on under integration that kept us from having to go forward with a huge busing program to bus children from all over into the city and from the city to all over. So we recommended a few magnet schools rather than do that.
And thank you, Madam Chair. And a point of clarification, if I wasn't clear, and I thank you for the opportunity. I'm very supportive of the magnet school process, of the you know, the integration schools that have been created out of that. I think it's good for kids. And so I greatly appreciate that. Now, I'm talking about the specific process where there was condemnation, an agreement entered into by property owners, the agreement entered into between the property owners and two separate school districts, and then the state taxpayers being asked to fund the settlement of the agreement. That's the process that concerns me, Madam Chair.
Sorry, Representative Biskins, I misunderstood. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Chair Sikora. Superintendent Wahlstrom, would you talk a little bit about the achievement of the Crosswind students on their tests for the state?
Madam Chair and Representative, our students score very well on the state tests. We have one of the cells in special education where we are not meeting the NCLB requirements, but other than that circumstance, our students are performing at or above the state averages with respect to state standard tests.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Chair Sikora. And Superintendent Wahlstrom, how do your students perform then when they transfer to their next step, their high schools?
Dr. Wahlstrom.
Madam Chair and Representative, we've not had the longitudinal opportunity to give you a definitive answer in that regard. We've been in operation since 2001. And so we were originally a 6-8 middle school. We're now added a ninth grade, and next year we will have grade 10. So we intend to, of course, provide that follow-through monitoring of student performance on the long term. But to date, we've not had that opportunity.
All right, Representative Newman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will say that I am very much in agreement with the concerns that Representative Biskins has raised. Mr. Squires, two questions. I think it was indicated that the mediated settlement agreement is here present, and I'm wondering if I could have a copy of that. My second question is, during the mediated settlement process, was there any discussion with the landowners about, for instance, a contingency in this mediated settlement agreement, which would address the issue of whether or not the state was going to pony the money up?
Mr. Squires?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I did not represent East Metro in the condemnation action. I wasn't present during the mediation. The firm of Briggs & Morgan, the St. Paul office, represented East Metro on the condemnation action. So I really couldn't say what the discussions were at that mediation. I could offer my reflection from doing condemnation work myself of what may have been discussed, but it would only be speculation.
Representative Goodman.
Mr. Squires, I now have received a copy of the mediated settlement agreement. Is the packet that I have been given multiple copies of the same document?
It's not that long.
I can clarify, Madam Chair. I feel better. There are 25 copies of the settlement agreement there, Madam Chair.
Thank you. We will get those passed out, Dr. Wahlstrom. Thank you. I was looking at the same thing and thinking, wow.
I'm going to set the speed read that one follow-up question.
Representative Newman.
Without Mr. Squires, without reading this document and taking everyone's time, do you know whether or not there is a provision in this mediated settlement agreement which would make the settlement agreement contingent upon the legislature agreeing to put up $1 million.
No, there is not. I'm familiar with the agreement, and there is, I'm sorry, and there is not a provision, a contingency in there that invalidates the agreement. Rather, what the parties obviously agreed to was to delay the payment required by a certain period of time to allow the parties to explore the funding options.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Are there any last comments? Oh, Representative Dorn.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe my question is for our staff analyst. I'm just in looking through the document. I'm trying to sort through what I've been hearing and the concerns, of people on the committee. And the line I'm looking at is the agreement provides for payment of land value costs in excess of the estimated amount provided by the legislature. And I'm wondering if you could help me understand how those amounts are estimated. It would seem to me that we would be careful about estimating too much, because that would become what the decision was. And what have we been in this position before, where an estimate is really an opening number that people know is rough but doesn't, determine the outcome? How do I interpret how we estimate a number, and then when we're asked to come back and fill in the remainder, how do I understand our estimating process?
Mr. Strong.
Representative Dorn, I don't speak to the current project, but for the rest of the Metropolitan Magnet School grants, essentially what's happened is the group of districts working on the grant has worked with an architect and others to come up with an idea, and they get preliminary costs as to what it will cost to build that building, including land acquisition costs. And then they present that as a total dollar value that they'd like to have approved as bond funds. So, for example, for the downtown Minneapolis Magnet, I believe it was a $10 million request. That request included the cost of the land acquisition, or the way that school was going to be jointly built with St. Thomas, and some other things were rolled into that number. So usually the number you see in a bonding project is somebody's estimate of what it's going to cost to build a facility. Now, you could ask the East Metro folks about the specific problems with this, but essentially this process there were a couple of issues that caused the cost of the school to be higher than what was initially budgeted. But there were also some legislative actions that, in fact, when the main appropriation was made out of there were four separate bonding appropriations for the building to date. When the main appropriation was made, there was actually language in the bonding bill saying this isn't for the full amount. We know there'll be more.
Mm-hmm.
So this one's a pretty unusual project, but in general what happens is the proposal comes to the committee and someone has a fixed idea of what those costs are going to be, including the land acquisition costs.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Strom. I don't know if they have a follow-up or a response to... Can you help me put this into a perspective?
Madam Chair.
Mr. Squire.
If I could address the last question about the estimate. Going forward, whenever you have an estimate for a project, particularly where you have an idea where the site is as you go through a site selection process, but you're not sure, it necessarily requires an estimate. Sometimes you spend more than that. Sometimes you spend less on a project of this nature. I can also say from my experience representing clients in that area in Woodbury that area over the last 10 or 15 years has experienced probably the greatest increase in terms of land values as any area in the metro area. Sites that were selling for $10,000 per acre in the early 90s are now selling and reselling for $150,000 to $200,000 an acre. So during the period that this project was planned and estimates were prepared to the time that the condemnation award was actually fixed was a period that also was during that rapid increase. So I think that may go to your question as well about why is the estimate different than the actual cost.
Thank you, Madam
Chair. I have one last. Representative Mesno, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a brief comment. I appreciate the concerns that Representatives Biskins and Newman expressed, and I think that as we look forward to a process, that might be a process for us to evaluate and look to take more of a proprietary role in that on behalf of the citizens of the state. But as I look at this particular project, it appears to me that EMID played by the rules as we set them out for them, moved forward with a project that we had directed some action from the metro area school districts, and as far as I can tell from reading the agreement, appears to have handled it very responsibly. And I'd hate to penalize them now and say, well, we don't want to support what they're doing because we think that the process was wrong. I think they really followed the process as it existed, and I don't think that they should be punished for that.
I think as a matter of fact, we recommended this last year, and it went into the bonding bill last year. And I just want to be reminded, what are the consequences if we don't do this? If Dr. Wallstrom?
Madam Chair and board members, if this request is not funded, the obligation that we have to repay the loan to the St. Paul schools is going to be in effect on the 1st of September. Our alternatives are to take that amount, $1,083,000, from a combination of the EMID operating budget and the integration revenue provided to our member districts. So it's going to impact our efforts to operate voluntary integrated learning opportunities for our students across those 10 districts.
Representative Clemson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to thank the committee for considering this request. I do think that it has a statewide impact in that it provides a choice for integrative districts. And so as we proceed, like Representative Medlow so well put it, we may not be happy with the process now, but let's take that into the future and not retroactively put that upon this request. And if you have any more questions as we move through the process, please don't hesitate to talk to me or one of the great testifiers.
Dr. Wallstrom, one last comment.
Madam Chair and board members, one last comment. I want to thank Representative Clemson for being here today despite her voice difficulties. I want to thank Representative Mariani for joining us as well. We have copies of the resolutions for the St. Paul and EMID school boards. We'll make those available to staff for distribution with regard to the loan arrangement. And one final comment would be that EMID is one of those categories described at the very start of today's proceedings in which we have no ability to raise these revenues on our own. We cannot levy. We don't receive any particular state aid for facilities. That's why we're before you today, and we thank you very much for your questions and for your attention to this matter. Thank you.
And thank you for your patient explanation. We will go on to House File 266. We will hold up, lay this over as we are doing with all the bonding until we have a chance to discuss them as a group and make our recommendations and take them forward. This is the Red Lake. Representative Saylor.
Madam Chair.
Representative Dabney.
Do you need a committee member to move House File 266 before the committee for consideration?
Yes.
I'd like to so move.
And this also will be then held over for consideration into our bonding requests that will go on to the Capital Investment Committee. Who would like to start?
Okay.
Representative Saylor.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair and representatives. I would just like to bring this forward as a continuation of the 2004 project. Many of you will probably remember this from last year. It was included in the bonding bill and went through this committee last year, and it's back again now. And it's regarding the new high school and middle school at Red Lake. And the last time that they had a high school built was 1949. And the current facility just does not meet code, nor does it is it conducive to educational endeavors. And the student population has grown. The programs and the activities have definitely outgrown this facility. And the temporary and portable structures that they're using now simply are not sufficient. I will defer to these fellows. I also want to let you know this is the superintendent of Red Lake, and that would be Stuart Bajolet. and the public school representative here, Monty Hammett. Also, I would like to direct your attention. The middle school students from Red Lake came down about a 4.5 to 5 hour trip, and other members of the Red Lake community are here as well today, the school board and others.
Welcome to all of you. I hope you enjoy your brief experience with government here today. Let's go forward. Would you just introduce yourself again into the microphone, please, as you begin to speak?
Yes, Madam Chairman, committee members, good afternoon. My name is Felicity Jarley, Superintendent of Schools, Red Lake School District, Red Lake, Minnesota. First off, I'd like to commend the students from Red Lake Middle School who got up early this morning about 4:45 and got on a bus at 7 o'clock and took a 5-hour trip to be here. Members of our Board of Education realize that this is a very important meeting concerning middle school funding bonding bill. I'd like to introduce our Board Chairman, Arnold Sheiky Pemberton, our Vice Chairman, Cookie DePoe, Keith DePoe, our Treasurer, Roy Nelson, Board Member Dorothy Kovanes, Donovan English, and Dolores Cloud, our Title IV Director. As we present the bonding bill again this year to this committee, we were here last year, and as we know, you know, everything was forwarded to this year. We sat here with a $22.1 million request last year, and with inflation and everything, we sit here now with a $24.04. Yeah. A 24.04 bonding request that has been recommended by the governor and by the Senate in meetings that we've held with them. Red Lake Middle School is located within the Red Lake School District. And as we get into the location of the Red Lake School District, it is located within the Red Lake Indian Reservation, the Red Lake Nation. Through the past years, we've had numerous problems with our middle school. Our middle school is a 1956 building. I went to first grade there back in 56. And we're expecting our students now to go there. Year 2000, we started our new bonding request, and we had a new elementary back in 1992. And our enrollment throughout the years has increased dramatically in our elementary. It has been hitting about 600 elementary kids K through 5. And as we get into the middle school, we have a sharp reduction in students. And one of the things is, the Board of Education has always maintained is, our children need adequate buildings, adequate classrooms. We provide those, and they will come. They will come to school. And our elementary school is proving that. Where we have at least 93% attendance each day from little kids, K through 5. And as we go into the middle school, and I don't know if any of the committee members have ever been to Red Lake, but in the past we've had committee members visit our middle school, visit our high school, and we've shown them our problems that we have. Last year we lost 13 days for mold problems in these two buildings, these two old buildings that we have, the 1949 high school and the 1956 middle school elementary addition. 13 school days that we could not recover due to mold problems. This year we've been fortunate. Right now my 7th grade, 8th grade classroom, we had two classrooms closed in this portion of the buildings that I've just mentioned in 1956 because of water pipes breaking. It's been 7 days since those students have been able to get back into their classroom. And as we go throughout the year, we have more and more problems with these portions of the middle school, of the buildings within our district. So there's 42 below here about 2.5 weeks ago up in Minnesota, and our boilers, our elementary, our middle school boiler went out because it couldn't handle the load. 42 below without a wind chill. Some of our propane was freezing as it got over to the boiler room. That's how cold it was. We had to cancel school because we had no heat in our middle school. Another day lost. I believe we lost 2 days there. As we continue on, our enrollment within the district continues to rise. And that's due to a number of reasons. Number one, that open enrollment. 4 years ago, we had open enrollment in the 300-400 students going to other schools in the surrounding district. We cut that in half. We have more students returning now from open enrollment and coming back to Red Lake High School, Red Lake School District. Our basketball team has four members right now, four of the five members on the starting team who have returned from open enrollment because they see a benefit now within our school, improvements. We see enrollment at the high school level at about 325. It was once 180 5 years ago. So our kids are coming back to open enrollment. More people are coming back to the Red Lake Nation from cities like Duluth, Minneapolis, St. Paul, coming home, bringing their kids back to Red Lake. And with that, our schools continue to fill up. What a classroom that once held 20, now holds 25 students. We have to handle, we have to take care of the people, the kids that come back. Red Lake, we had flooding, like it indicated, during Christmas time. We have, in our K-0-4 Head Start programs, we have 60 kids right now in the four-year-old level that are unable to go to Head Start because there's no room. Out of 200 fourth graders, 204-year-olds. And these kids are coming into the Red Lake School District next year. Like I said, you know, the middle, the elementary school buildings are adequate. They're surviving. But they need, you know, we need more classrooms there. We just keep building within the elementary because of the birds, the people coming back, the young people. We talk about ISD 30 at Red Lake School District. We're a public school. Well, under state law, we have all the reports, mandatory compensatory reports that we have to do. We have to submit to the state. Curriculum. Mandates, standards, no child left behind. We follow all of those. Red Lake Nation surrounds us. Surrounds the Red Lake School District. I believe that the last time, the last count we looked, we did a check, we get about maybe $20,000-$25,000 from the Red Lake Nation to help us with our school district. And most of it is donations for programs. Donations like to Close Up, where we send our students to Washington, D.C. We sent 20 kids last time, 20 kids to Washington, D.C. for a week. At this time, I'd like to introduce Monty Hammett, consultant of Cloud Hammett Associates. He's been working with our district in a bonding issue now for about 4 years. Monty?
May I just ask a question first, Mr. DeJarlis?
Yes.
You said something that interested me. You said so many families are returning to the Red Lake area. I'm wondering, is there some economic development going on up there that's providing jobs so that people are coming back?
The Tribal Council just held, the Red Lake Nation Tribal Council just held a meeting out at one of their casinos. Said that addressed the economic development within the nation. I was not in attendance at that meeting. I know there's a series of additional meetings scheduled. We do have, you know, there is an unemployment problem, you know, within the Red Lake Nation.
That's great that you're working on economic development. I just wondered, you said a lot of families have returned, and I wondered, you know, what kind of jobs they were finding as they return. Mr. Hammett?
Madam Chair, committee members, one of the aspects of the individuals returning is that we're finding some in the, if you will, late 20s and early 30s who have completed their college educations and are returning home and finding work throughout in the reservation administrative tasks. We have teachers that are coming back to the classroom who have families. We have a tremendous housing shortage that was addressed at a forum. Like they need an additional 500 houses, so we got several families living together. Some of these folks have lost their jobs here in the cities through different manufacturing programs, going someplace cells are folding and not there. So the influx is great in multiple areas within the anomaly, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Go ahead, Mr. Hammett. You were going to, I think, talk about some other things, and I interrupted you.
Yes. Thank you very much, Madam Chair and committee members. As the Superintendent Jarley had mentioned and Representative Saylor had mentioned, that the process we started here was started at the school district in identifying the unmet facility needs based upon the crucial areas of having the mold and having asbestos and having old buildings for the children to have to try to learn in an unsafe environment. The school district put forth a review and comment in 2001, presented to the state board or State Department of Education at that time, Children, Families, and Learning. That was put forth for $39 million from the district's point of view to correct all of the educational facility needs. That was corrected and increased to $40 million by the State Department of Finance, and the difference in the numbers was the inflationary factor the state used was higher than what we had projected in that thing. In that process, during the Governor Ventura's administration, he recommended that there be $12.4 million set aside for doing some construction and $500,000 set aside to do a pre-design documentation identifying the needs of the facilities, the operational costs, and cost analysis of various construction within. And we're very, very pleased, Madam Chair and committee members, to say that this documentation, it's a two-volume document to put together with the cooperation of the State Department of Education, now State Department of Finance, and they did an absolutely excellent job in working with us. And I think this answers the representative's question about the process we have is a very thorough, examined process. We delivered this to the State Department of Education, State Department of Finance, and all committee chairs of the House and the Senate last October of 2004. And we now, out of that 2002 bonding bill of $12,004, of which $11,900,000 was for construction dollars, we're very, very pleased, Madam Chair and committee members, to report that that project has been completed on time and within and under budget. And we're very, very pleased. And our students are very, very pleased also to have these ADAPT facilities there. Last year, 2004, we prepared in accordance to the plan documentation and the master plan of facilities that goes through 2013, that in that proposed review and comment we submitted to the Department of Education, that was in the amount of $33 million for looking at the development of a new middle school. This new middle school concept was a part of the planning, and let me just speak just briefly to the planning which started in 2001. The planning process we used is probably a little different than most districts use. We used our spiritual leaders were involved, our elders were involved, our students were involved, our veterans were involved, and our community. We, at the reservation level, have a different sense, I think, of what cooperative planning means, and we plan for this on behalf of our young children who are here today to maintain and sustain the culture, the traditions, the values of the Ojibwe Nation and the Ojibwe people across the country. So this is an absolute must for us of making sure that that input is given and this input is adhered to. So when we put together our review and comment for 2004, the $33 million was submitted, as I mentioned, to the Department of Education, Department of Finance, the Governor's Office, and also to the chairs of the House and the Senate. Of that amount last year, that was reduced to $22.1 million from the Governor's Office, and we maintained, sustained that portion of the 33 through the Senate until the final of Senate, and we all agreed that we will cut back on the middle school. And the reason we cut back on that, Madam, was that through this planning process, if anybody's familiar with the reservation, we have a town in Panema, Minnesota, which is on the north shore of the lower lake, which is 35 miles from Red Lake, and the folks in the communities wanted a middle school to be somewhere located between the two systems, so it would be not as far for the students, young students, to have to travel. After the reduction from the 33 to the 22.1 million, we went back to the drawing board and said we're going to have to come up with a plan, which we did, which was very similar to the first plan that we submitted to you folks back in 2002 of locating on the same location. The reason for this, we saved $7 million in terms of site costs, water, sewer, electrical, all the infrastructure costs were saved by attaching to and making this a movement. So that's how we arrived back at the $22.1 million, which was in the governor's budget. At the time also, Madam Chair, I think it's very, very important that the superintendent had mentioned that the additions we've had in the committees that we've been before, you folks have been extremely gracious to us. We want to thank you kindly, because there's no way we could possibly have good school facilities without your help. And in this process, when we testified in the last 2 years, we are very cognizant, Madam Chair, committee members, that we preserve the assets that the state has given us. In other words, the current and existing facilities that are not 40, 50 years old, we protect those that have been given in the last 10, 12 years, so that asset and that preservation is mingled right in with the current existing floor of the existing structure and getting rid of the old 1949 and the other pieces that don't meet code. And it's important, I think, also, Madam Chair and committee members, to also keep in mind that part of this, in working with the State Department Administration, State Department of through the design process, and the State Department of Education, State Department of Finance, the state has a ruling that whereby if it's going to cost more than 60% to renovate, you're better off, and they recommend that you do a new facility. So this kind of brings us along the trail, Madam Chair, and from that we had now resubmitted a review and comment from, I think it was, and Audrey can correct me here, I think it was like from December 29th to January 3rd, I think, is when we delivered the new review and comment that you have before you and in front of you. So these 3 or 4 days of constant work, and we appreciate the efforts of the State Department of Education. They were getting emails at 10, 11 o'clock at night. And so Audrey, as State Department of Education, thank you folks for working with us and helping us with this. We have, I think, an excellent collaborative effort, Madam Chair, with your committees and with the state, and we look at this as a team. And we're before you today, Madam Chair, to ask if you will reconsider the governor's request, the Senate's request, and what makes it difficult is when we don't get the funding within the phases, we got to go back then and readjust the feasibility study, if you will, the master plan of facility, and we have to try to work when we're working with old buildings. It really makes it difficult for us to pull all of these little pieces together. So we would hope to, and we would appreciate if the committee could help us in sticking with the master plan of facilities, sticking with the planned way. And by the way, this was a mandate from the state legislature, your body, to do this master plan and put it in place so that we have a road to get us to the end, so we don't have to keep coming back constantly. So, Madam Chair, with that, the superintendent may have some additional comments or a stand.
Mr. Hammett, one quick question. I'm, you know, looking at the materials that we have here. You will be back next year to request $41 million more for high school renovation.
That is correct, Madam Chair and committee members. This is all tied to the master plan, and the results sound huge, but if we look back and go back to what the needs are in terms of being able to renovate, we could have done most of this for about $40 million 2 years ago.
And then after this $41 million, would there be anything else coming up in the future that you would be
I hope not, Madam Chair. I hope not.
You're sick of the trip down here, I bet, huh?
Well, this is the third time this is within the last week. Yes, but we think yes. This would really be nice, Madam Chair. It's like Superintendent DeJardi says, we have 200 3-year-olds, we have 200 4-year-olds. Of the 3-year-olds, there's only 50 that can get into the Head Start program because there's no space. And they've allocated 150 for the 4-year-olds, with 50-some still can't get into the... And the plan for them is bringing the early childhood in 2006, and we're coming forth with a review and comment, which we talked to the department head about, for this process to finalize, bringing the early childhood and the elementary school together, and to renovate the high school and bring that all up to date, so that those influx from the middle school and they get the high school will be there. In addition, to review and modernize the Panema Media Center, which is very outdated. And if that request is honored, Madam Chair, which we hope it would be, we hope that, first of all, that the $24,040,000 is honored first, but this would really help us finish up the entire block, and I would not see the school district having to come back for a number of years.
Thank you very much. Other questions for Ms. Representative Erickson?
Thank you, Chair Sikora. Mr. Strom, when did Red Lake receive its maximum effort loan, and what is owed on that?
Madam Chair, and we may need the department to clarify on whether this is going to be a maximum effort loan again. I believe in the Senate bill it is. Last year it was. In House File 266, it's drafted as a straight grant.
Right.
The administration's gone back and forth on how to count the repayment on the maximum effort loan for Red Lake, because essentially what happens, since they have no tax base, they never make a repayment to the state, and so the interest compounds on the loan. And I think finance would need to address whether they're still counting it that way or not. It used to be for each year that the loan went unpaid, that amount then would get added to the total. So the amount owed was quite large on the earlier maximum effort loans to the school district, but I believe finance has changed their policy on how they count those now, but we'd need finance to speak to that.
Madam Chair.
Representative Erickson.
Mr. Strom, were the previous loans to Red Lake maximum effort, or was that just an earlier loan?
Madam Chair, Representative Erickson, yes, they were done under the maximum effort program.
Madam Chair.
Representative Erickson.
Superintendent DeJarli, you have to lease the land on which your schools are built. Is that correct? And if so, what's the lease payment you make to the tribal government?
The lease,
DeJarli.
The land that we get from the Red Lake Nation is not leased. It's given. It's given to the state. It's given to us, the Red Lake School District, for 50 years. We have our lease for 50 years. There's no cost to it. But from the tribe, they don't charge us. They just give us the land.
Madam Chair.
Representative Erickson.
Superintendent DeJarli, if in fact the state would enter into an agreement to have a state tribal casino with your tribe, White Earth and Leech, do you think that the families then would move to this Twin City area because there'd be jobs available for them? And what might that do to your school enrollment?
I think our school enrollment would stay the same. The casino problems in the school district doesn't take a side with the casino, any casino issues. We have our school district to run. I believe, that most people would stay at Red Lake.
So, Madam Chair.
Representative.
And Superintendent, but there will be jobs here. Wouldn't that, in a sense, bring some of the Red Lake folks back? Because I know some have returned to the reservation because of economic development through the casino employment. But you don't think that would happen if this agreement were entered into?
Mr. DeJarli.
No, I don't. I believe there's enough Native Americans that live in St. Paul, Minneapolis, that would take those jobs.
Madam Chair, just to follow up on that, as I mentioned earlier, a lot of these folks who are returning are professional folks who have finished later life college and do have these families.
All right, are there any further questions for either Mr. Hammett? I'm sorry, Representative Browning, I didn't see you.
Madam Chair, I raised my hand after you already scanned this site, so it's not your fault.
I would just like to thank the students for coming. It's always a great gratification on this committee to see who we are discussing and what we are discussing for. It makes it a lot clearer to see your bright faces, so thank you. My question is, I notice in here there's a technology plan. Could you describe the technology opportunities that the students have right now compared to what it would be in the new school?
Mr. Desjardins?
Our technology plan right now, you know, covers a wide range of advances that, in computers. We have an A-plus lab that we have available right now for middle school and high school. We also have a tech lab, a fairly up-to-date tech lab for the high school and middle school kids. Our technology plan, you know, as each year goes by, it changes because, you know, technology changes every day. You know, and we try to keep up with the changes. You know, we have two excellent technology technicians in the district that keep us aware, you know, what we should do. We have a number of roving labs right now. I believe there's one there with like 25 laptop computers, you know, and you push it to a room and the kids get a computer. So we're pretty well up to date on technology, you know. One of the things we'd like to do, you know, the district would like to see is more internet services within the home. And I believe, you know, the E-rate may cover that later on. Through the government, through the federal government. And I know Dave Smith, our technology person, is looking into that. But we're pretty well up. We've got some good technology programs within our district.
Madam Chair, maybe just a little follow-up, if I may, committee members and Madam Chair, that in this process, when we added the classrooms onto the high school, we added them onto early childhood. This is part of that 12-4. This is one of the things that we went to the engineers in the technology division to make sure that any additions that we come up with is going to be adaptable to the highest level of technology, and it can be put in without having to renovate and tear down what was built 2 years before that. So we're moving in that direction. Another area in terms of technology, which I think is fantastic, is the aspect that we got smart boards now in the classrooms. Not all, but we're starting this new technology, and the teachers love it. The students are loving it and getting on. They're absolutely, I don't know if you're familiar with them, but if you get a chance to see a school district that has smart boards in it, it's like a big computer up front up there, and they can put all of their lesson plans, everything that they want to do, and it's the highest level of technology that we can get to. And we certainly strongly suggest, and we've worked with TIES, the organization here that does work, so that we maintain that important aspect of technology for our students for the future.
I think I'm noticing some slightly green faces around the table, so people who don't quite have that technology. Representative Dimmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have two questions, really. First, could you describe a little bit your relationship with the local casino, what they're doing in support of the schools? I know a lot of times, major industries work with their school districts with different programs and that sort of thing. Can you describe what's going on up in Red Lake?
The casino or the Red Lake Tribal Council, you know, they're a separate entity from the school district. We have no say in what they do with their money, no input on how they spend their money. They do give us about $20,000-$25,000. A lot of it is in donations. I mentioned our close-up program, the tribe. Usually funds at least a quarter of that, a third of that, you know, for the students. As far as anything else, you know, we don't seek casino funds. You know, that's a tribal matter, and like I said, we try to stay out of tribal matters. We have a district.
Okay, thank you. Madam Chair, one more question.
Representative Kemmer.
I'm curious, too, about your school district. As you mentioned before, that you are complying with No Child Left Behind, and I assume doing all the testing and that sort of thing. How are your students doing? How is your compliance? Are you making adequate yearly progress? Can you give us a little bit of background on that? I could get that, but as long as you're here, I'll just ask.
Mr. DeCharlie.
Yeah, No Child Left Behind, you know, it has its faults. one of the things is, you know, I believe, you know, our Board of Education has looked at that, that, you know, it serves as a deterrent to Title I schools and schools in minority. We're trying our best to meet this, you know, what No Child Left Behind has left in, has put in place, has mandated, without the proper funding, you know, for a school district of our size. We do have met, you know, highly qualified teachers. We've met that. We're working with our paras right now to get them by January 2006. You know, they need that 2-year degree or that para pro assessment. And the Board of Education has placed that as a priority in getting the paras all certified. You know, if they're not certified, they lose their job. We did make progress here last year, 2 years ago, in our No Child Left Behind. We did make Redick Elementary did slip in, I believe, math this year. No, reading. They did slide in reading, but they did okay in the math. Panema Elementary did very good in the math, but again in the reading. And Panema is on a 2-year continuous improvement plan, so they are making progress under the No Child Left Behind mandates. With the safe choice schools and working with the compliance at the offices over at MDE. We are Red Lake 2 years ago was a 3-star school, you know. And I know the board, you know, we like to see 3-star school, but, you know, we like to see 4 and 5 too. Yeah. And that's our goal is, you know, 5-star schools within every building, you know, that has to meet the goals of the mandates of the No Child Left Behind. So we are making progress. It's a tedious one, especially, you know, there's a number of situations that we have that are unique to other school districts under the No Child Left Behind. Number one, our mobility rate. You know, sometimes, you know, halfway through the school year, we get, you know, 15 new kids coming to the building, you know, and as a school district, we have to serve them. And we have no really experience in getting them prepared for the testing. Like today, we had over writing test today for 10th and 11th graders is today. And one of our teachers had to go over to the police station because four young people were picked up yesterday. So to meet that, we had to take the test to them. If not, that was penalty points against us. We also have to look at, our special ed, you know, and the mandates, you know, that we test all special ed kids, you know. And I myself, you know, that's wrong, you know. I believe, you know, No Child Left Behind faults us there. Not because, you know, that they're special ed kids, but, you know, because, you know, we have to prepare for them. We have to accommodate them. But we're making progress.
So you feel that under No Child Left Behind, achievement is improving, right?
Yes.
That's what I heard you say? Okay.
Yes, ma'am.
So in that case, maybe No Child Left Behind is doing what it was supposed to do.
I believe, yes. No Child Left Behind is doing what it's supposed to do, but I believe the Board of Education has taken some alternative approaches in making sure that, you know, those goals are met.
I have one last question. Having seen no others here, I have one last question, and that's, you mentioned Title IV, and can you tell me, I know that's federal funds that go to Indian tribes and so on, but can you just tell me how much Red Lake would get out of that program?
Yes, I would like to call, you know, my Title IV director, Dolores Cloud Hammond, to answer that question.
Good afternoon, members of the committee, Madam Chair.
Would you say the name again?
Dolores Cloud Hammett.
Dolores Cloud Hammett, right.
I'm the Director of Indian Education Programs in the School District. You asked about how ESEA funds mm-hmm. Title VII. It's based on a per capita generated by state numbers per student. The state per capita has decreased tremendously. At one point, several years ago, maybe 10 years, where we were at number 9, and now we're at 27 across the state of Minnesota. That impacts how much money we get through Title VII ESEA. Last year, we had about a $300,000 budget. This year, it was cut to $285,000. I don't know what we're going to have for next year. So that source of funding is primarily geared for culturally relevant education for our school students. We're doing language programs, American Indian Arts and Crafts programs, and we also are involved with some technology to introduce high tech to our students. Does that answer your question?
I believe so. Did anybody else?
Based on state funding. It's a per capita based on state funding, and the state funding keeps going down, and the feds also will use that formula for us.
The state funding for what keeps going down?
Per capita. Per student.
Oh.
Per student funding. Per student in the state of Minnesota keeps going down. We were at number 9, now we're at 27 for the state of Minnesota. I went to a Department of Finance meeting where I was able to collect the data from. As a matter of fact, tomorrow afternoon there's going to be a No Child Left Behind testimony gathered by ESEA Title VII. Federal regulations require that by President Bush, and I will be testifying on behalf of the Red Lake Public Schools, and I will be talking about some of the data that I was able to garner from the Department of Finance.
So you're talking about the federal dollars.